This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Vernon Loeb, is the defense correspondent for The Washington Post and is one of the Post reporters who is following the story of Saddam Hussein's capture. Loeb was in Iraq from mid-October to late November covering the U.S. military. He spent 3 to 4 days with each major division in Iraq and was briefly embedded with the brigade that later captured Saddam Hussein. After embedding with a division, Loeb would spend a couple of days in Baghdad at the Washington Post's house, where he'd make arrangements to embed with the next division. This morning, I talked with Vernon Loeb about his experiences covering the military in Iraq and about the capture of Saddam Hussein. What have your military sources been telling you about the significance of the capture of Saddam Hussein and how it may or may not affect the insurgency?
Well, I think they all think it's a huge development, primarily because it's a final sign to the Iraqi people that this guy is gone. He's not going to come back and terrorize them. But I think they're also very unclear about what it's really going to mean for the insurgency. One of the striking things about the U.S. military involvement in Iraq is that commanders don't really seem to know all that much about who they're fighting. And in fact, a number of them we spoke to yesterday, you know, hours after Saddam's capture, basically said, we think there's going to be a spike in attacks now, which is kind of counterintuitive.
Why do they think that?
Well, I think they think the insurgents will attempt to show that they have independent power, that they weren't dependent on Saddam for leadership, for financing, for direction. And many of the insurgents may not be Ba'athists following Saddam. And one of the big unknown questions in Iraq is, as I said, who is the enemy? American commanders are fond of saying it's 90% Ba'athists. But that's really just a guess on their part. And there's a whole lot of people in the country, some in the military, who basically think that it's a lot more than just Ba'athists. It's foreign terrorists, possibly linked to al-Qaeda. It's local Iraqi religious extremists called Wahhabis. And a large element may purely be Iraqi nationalism. So I think to a great extent, we're going to see, now that Saddam Hussein has been captured, who the U.S. is really fighting in Iraq.
In an article that you co-reported, there's a quote from Major General Raymond Odierno, who is the major of the men who captured Saddam Hussein. And he says that he didn't believe that Saddam Hussein was coordinating the effort because he didn't think there really was any national coordination for the insurgency. What did he mean by that?
Well, you know, I think to a great extent, military commanders are just kind of guessing about that point. I mean, Ray Odierno is the commander of the 4th Infantry Division. He has responsibility for sort of Tikrit and north central Iraq. And he has a pretty good picture of the insurgency in his area of operations. I'm not sure he coordinates all that well with the 1st Armored Division down in Baghdad or with the 101st up north. So I don't really believe commanders in Iraq have ever really put the national picture together very well. And thus, they tend to draw, I think, conclusions on the basis of their own areas of operation. So to General Odierno, there doesn't seem to be much national coordination because, again, he's primarily focused on his area of operations. I personally believe, and again, this is a guess on my part as well, that there is more national coordination than U.S. military commanders typically acknowledge.
Why do you think that?
Well, you know, I think if you look back at the attacks going all the way back to the bombing of the Jordanian embassy in Baghdad back in the summer, you know, and then that was followed by the bombing of the U.N. headquarters, the car bombings of the police stations, the attacks on the Italians and the Poles. Clearly, the insurgents have a pretty well-thought-out campaign plan. In fact, a number of analysts here in the U.S. have commented that it seems as though the insurgents have a better campaign plan than we do. All of this suggests to me that there is some level of national coordination, that they have been quite deliberate in striking U.S. allies after the U.S. targets became too hard to hit. And they've been quite deliberate in showing almost sequentially that they're able to strike all over the country, even in cities like Mosul, where the U.S. military thought they were making great progress. All of this to me suggests that there is some national coordination.
When you were in Iraq and you were there for about 5 weeks in October and November, could you get any sense of the popular support for the insurgency? Were people willing to express to you support for it?
I think there is a fair amount of popular support for the insurgency, just as I think there's a fair amount of popular support for the Americans. When I was there, I spent most of my time being a defense correspondent with U.S. military forces. So I was kind of reporting on the war as they saw it. My colleagues in the Washington Post Baghdad Bureau spent most of their time on the other side of the divide, talking to Iraqis about how they perceived the U.S. military. And I was constantly struck by how we were really looking at two worlds apart. The commanders would say one thing, and my colleagues would get a completely different take from the Iraqis themselves. And it really led me to believe that one of the biggest problems that American commanders face in Iraq is that they get their intelligence from the Iraqis who are basically working with them. And to a great extent, I think the Iraqis working with them are very much into telling the Americans what they think the Americans want to hear. And I think that while the American military does have some support among the Iraqi people, I think, nonetheless, it gets a very skewed picture of the kind of support that it really has. And I don't think its support among the Iraqi people is as deep as commanders sometimes think it is.
Can you give us an example of the kind of discrepancy you're talking about between what you saw in the military and what your colleagues reporting on civilians were telling you?
Sure. Commanders uniformly would tell me that the Iraqi Civil Defense Corps that they are training and standing up in their sectors was a terrific new force, that the Iraqi soldiers taking part in it were thrilled to be, you know, operating with the Americans, had real military potential. And indeed, one of the primary metrics the American commanders use for gauging their own success was the willingness of Iraqis to volunteer for this new force. And by Iraqi standards, they're actually paid pretty well. I think the salaries are anywhere from $120 to $180 a month. Saddam, by contrast, paid his officers about $50 a month. I was struck when one of my colleagues then went out and spent the day with an ICDC unit on the ground in Baiji. This colleague of mine is named Anthony Shadid. He's a Lebanese-American. He speaks fluent Arabic. So it's very hard for people in Iraq really to tell who he is. I'm not sure they even know he's an American reporter, so that when he goes out, he's not suffering from this plague of Iraqis telling Americans what they think the Americans want to hear. And what Anthony got from the ICDC was a completely different picture. They basically told him they don't like the Americans very much, they're serving with them only for the money because they need to feed their families, and that as soon as the Americans leave, they're going to take their silly baseball hats and throw them away and, you know, make some other kind of calculation about where they fit into Iraqi society. So to me, that was really a striking example of how you had these completely different takes on the quality of the Iraqi Civil Defense Corps.
My guest is Vernon Loeb, defense correspondent for The Washington Post, and he was last in Iraq during October and November. Have you met Major General Odierno, the major of the troops that captured Saddam Hussein?
I have. I've interviewed him. I've spent some time with him flying around his sector. And he's quite an interesting and remarkable man. He's very large. He's 6'5". I think he weighs about 250 pounds. He once played tight end for the West Point football team. But he's also quite cerebral. He has a master's degree in an engineering degree in nuclear effects. So he's this sort of, you know, typical Army combination of muddy boots, brawn, and brains.
And as an example of the kinds of things he has to deal with, one or two days before the capture of Saddam Hussein, he was dealing with fining one of his own men for having done something he shouldn't have done. Won't you explain what that was about?
Sure. One of General Odierno's battalion commanders, a lieutenant colonel named Alan West, this summer, while he was interrogating an Iraqi detainee, basically to frighten this detainee into divulging information, fired his pistol by the detainee's ear. And this came after he had basically allowed his men to beat the detainee. They believed this Iraqi had information about a planned ambush against U.S. forces, and they were determined to get some information out of this guy. General Odierno learned of this interrogation through some anonymous letters from troops who witnessed it, and he immediately commenced a criminal investigation. then it was up to him, after the facts were in and after Lieutenant Colonel West basically acknowledged what he'd done, General Odierno had to decide, do I court-martial this guy or do I punish him administratively? And it became a huge cause celeb within the Army. Many, many officers rallied to Lieutenant Colonel West's side. People on Capitol Hill were expressing outrage that he was being court-martialed or could face court-martial. And last week, General Odierno finally ended the controversy by administratively fining the Lieutenant Colonel $5,000 and basically ending his career.
Do you know why he decided to take that route instead of the court-martial?
Well, I think it was basically the extenuating circumstances of the whole thing. I mean, the whole case really spoke to the kind of moral difficulties of fighting an insurgency. West's supporters basically said, look, here was a guy who believed his men might be killed by these insurgents, and he had somebody in front of him who had the information. And so he was left with a choice, how far do I go in getting information from this Iraqi in order to protect my men? And I think it was because he faced that very difficult moral choice that General Odierno ultimately decided that it would be inappropriate to court-martial, you know, criminally send this man to jail for what he had done. Many disagreed. I know some legal military experts basically believe that West should have been court-martialed for allowing his men to beat the detainee. They saw that as a more egregious act than actually firing his gun in the Iraqi's ear. But again, it was a very tough situation. I mean, think of it yourself. Think of your children. Somebody had kidnapped your children, and you had someone before you who had information about their whereabouts. How far would you go in trying to get information out of that individual? That's sort of the choice that West faced. And in punishing him, Odierno had to weigh not only his acts, but sort of the context in which he acted.
Vernon, I don't know if this is something you want to speculate about or not, but do you get the impression that actually there's a lot of behavior like this going on that isn't getting reported and therefore isn't getting officially scrutinized by the military?
My sense is that there isn't a lot of this going on, that this was kind of unusual and indeed so unusual that it was reported to the commanding general by troops who witnessed it. My sense was that U.S. soldiers were really quite disciplined and professional over there. None of them want to spend a year in Iraq, obviously, but I thought morale was quite high because, you know, most of the active duty forces, at least, were doing what they joined the military to do, which was to fight. All the studies show that actually retention in units is higher when units are in the field fighting than it is when they're back sitting around their bases training. So I found morale to be high, and I found professionalism among the troops to be remarkably high.
My guest is Vernon Loeb, defense correspondent for The Washington Post. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Vernon Loeb, defense correspondent for The Washington Post. One of the places you visited when you were in Iraq in October and November was Aouja, which is near Saddam Hussein's hometown, and many of his relatives live in Aouja. The town has basically been fenced in. Can you describe what the town looks like now?
Sure. Aouja is actually very close to Adar, where they captured Saddam. It's probably 5 miles away. It's actually Saddam's birthplace. And because it was his birthplace, he went there and basically leveled all the shacks where he was born and built quite nice houses, perhaps even mansions for his clansmen and his family members. You know, it looks like a suburban American neighborhood. It's probably got 300 or 400 houses inside, maybe on 5 square kilometers. And right now it's encircled in concertina wire, and everybody who lives there must come and go through one common checkpoint. One of General Odierno's lieutenant colonels came up with the idea of using this sort of reverse strategic Hamlet method to control the population. They felt that a lot of the people plotting the insurgency were living inside Aouja, and they were just having terrible time sort of getting control of these people. figuring out when they were coming and going and kind of getting through to them. And so they encircled the town in barbed wire. They gave everybody ID passes, except for about 40 people in the town. And those 40 people they thought were the real bad guys. And they basically said to them, if you want to leave this town, you got to come and talk to us, and you got to come and tell us what you know. Everybody else can come and go through our checkpoint, but you 40 bad guys have to remain in place. And it's when they really started working on the family members like this back in early November that they really started sort of breaking through the web of connections that were that had been protecting Saddam. And I think it's just this kind of attention to family members and Klansmen that actually led them to Saddam on Saturday.
There's a risk that a maneuver like that would backfire because there could be so much resentment that a town is basically being fenced in like that, and that people who had been important under Saddam Hussein are prevented from, you know, from leaving town. Has there been any backlash against this maneuver?
Well, that's a really good point. And repeatedly, you know, American military commanders over there stress that, you know, we have to do our offensive operations in such a way that we don't create more bad guys in alienating the population than we take off the street in, you know, detaining the people we're looking for. So there is this constant sort of calibration. Okay, we're going to do a raid, but how can we do it in such a way where we don't alienate everybody in the neighborhood? In fact, they even sometimes after raids, they have these parties that come back the next day with engineers to fix any broken doors they may have broken down during the raid, to, you know, hand out soccer balls, to talk to the people, to sort of do sort of counter-raid, you know, repairs. In the town of Ahuja, I think that's less of a problem because everyone in Ahuja intensely hates the U.S. military. They don't really have the hearts and minds problem there because they're never going to win the hearts and minds of these people. So I think in this particular case, there was less to lose in terms of alienating the population than is the case, you know, most everywhere else in Iraq.
Were you traveling with the military when you were in Ahuja?
Yeah, I traveled with the military all over the country. Actually, it was one of the most sort of scary things you had to do, which was just riding around with them. You know, when you ride around with the U.S. military, you basically have a target, you know, painted on you. And a lot of these roadside bombs are command detonated, and the insurgents only detonate them when military vehicles are going by. So, yeah, just traveling around with the military in Iraq can be pretty dangerous. In fact, one of my colleagues, ex-colleagues from the Washington Post, a reporter named Michael Weisskopf, lost his hand last week in Baghdad when he was with troops from the 1st Armored Division in a Humvee, and somebody threw a hand grenade in.
I heard that he had caught the grenade and threw it out. Is that right?
Yeah, apparently he didn't catch it. He picked it up and sort of landed at his feet and threw it out of the Humvee, and it went off either in his hand or, you know, shortly after he'd let it go. And in doing so, he probably saved his own life and those of 4 soldiers and a photographer in the Humvee at the same time. Even as it was, he lost his hand. His photographer was seriously injured by shrapnel, and all 4 of the soldiers were injured. And again, that's just sort of, you know, riding around in Baghdad. You have no idea when an incident like that is going to happen. And, you know, oftentimes the things that seem the safest turn out to be the most dangerous.
Like what?
It's riding around, you know, in a Humvee, going to get the mail, riding down to Baghdad International Airport. I mean, a lot of these soldiers who've been killed or seriously injured have been, you know, clerks taking the mail down to the airport. In fact, the main road to the airport was so bad that the U.S. military has sort of defoliated the whole thing now, cut down all the trees on either side of the road so, you know, the insurgents can't hide in there and fire RPGs and plant these bombs. I think they're actually getting on top of the roadside bomb problem now, but it's one of the things that makes being with the U.S. military, you know, quite scary in Iraq.
Vernon Loeb is defense correspondent for The Washington Post. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Vernon Loeb, defense correspondent for The Washington Post. He spent 5 weeks in Iraq beginning October 15th, covering the U.S. military. He spent 3 to 4 days with each major division in Iraq. Fighting the insurgency has proved to be difficult and dangerous. I asked Vernon Loeb about the morale of the troops.
Well, I think morale is really horrible among reservists and National Guardsmen. These are guys who went over there thinking that they were going to be there for 6 months, and in September, coming up to the end of their six-month tours, they were suddenly told, oh, guess what, we've just changed the rules, and it's 1 year in country. A lot of these people have jobs that they're not in and watching other people take. They've been away from their families for a long time. I mean, these are just sort of, you know, ordinary people who are the weekend warriors and suddenly find, you know, 4 weekends a year becoming a year in Iraq. So their morale is quite low. On the other hand, the active duty forces, I found morale to be quite high. These are people who primarily break down into two groups, 21 and 22-year-olds who volunteered for the military because they wanted to fight, and they're officers who have been in the military for, you know, anywhere from 10 to 20 years, training and studying for this very moment, the ability to go to war. So I think the morale is very high still among the active duty forces. And I think another key thing in understanding the U.S. military is the way they see casualties. While, us civilians looking from the outside think one or two soldiers killed a day are high casualties, the military doesn't really see it that way. Casualties are a fact of life in the military. And I don't think casualties are anywhere near high enough to start affecting morale. I mean, remember, you know, at the height of the Vietnam War, casualties were like 500 a week. Here, they're more like 5 or 6 a week, with maybe, you know, 30 or 40 soldiers being wounded. I was with battalions who'd been in Iraq for, you know, going on 8 or 9 months at that point, who hadn't lost a single soldier. So I think casualties, while high and while, in some sense, you know, distressingly high to those of us on the outside, are not that high to the military mind.
Did you find that there was any friction between the military and civilian leadership in Iraq? I'm not sure if you had a seat where you could see that kind of difference, even if it did exist, but were you able to see how the two are connecting?
Well, I never saw them interact per se, but I repeatedly heard military commanders expressing extreme frustration about the coalition provisional authority in Baghdad. The military commanders saw the CPA people as you know, bureaucrats, as impediments to work around, as people who, for one reason or another, you know, could never make things that the military commanders needed on the ground happen. A classic example was the commander's emergency response program, which was created early on upon their arrival in Iraq. Basically, somebody had the really good idea of taking Iraqi confiscated dollars and giving them to military commanders almost in sort of slush funds, very unencumbered funds that they could use however they wanted to get things moving very quickly in their communities. And the commanders used them to great effect. You know, they would give a sheikh $1,000 to have his men, you know, police up a school in their neighborhood. They used them to start rehabbing schools, rehabbing soccer fields. They really used this money to get things going in Iraq. And by September, all of these Iraqi confiscated funds were gone. They'd been spent. And so the commanders started asking for American dollars to replace this money so they could keep these, you know, hearts and minds activities going. And the CPA basically said, well, you know, the supplementals, you know, being debated in Congress and we can't give you any money right now. You're going to have to do without for a while. So they had this critical period this fall of a couple of months where all of the, you know, emergency response funds dried up. And I think a lot of commanders really believe the sort of surge in attacks coincided with that, as their ability to do good things for the Iraqi people waned. The insurgents took advantage of that, moved in, and stepped up their attacks. I understand the money is now flowing again, but it was a classic example of a bureaucracy just not being able to move fast enough to give these commanders what they needed.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Vernon Loeb, defense correspondent for The Washington Post, and he was in Iraq for 5 weeks starting in mid-October. What was one of the most interesting missions that you accompanied troops on?
Well, one was definitely when I embedded with the 82nd Airborne. No sooner had I arrived than they told me we were going downtown to relieve about 100 soldiers who were literally holding the mayor's office in downtown Fallujah, which had been burned and overrun the day before by Iraqi rioters. So our mission was to go in and relieve about 100 guys who'd been holding this police station, mayor's office compound for a day. And no sooner had we arrived at this compound, sort of driven in and had the gate closed behind us, than, you know, a rocket-propelled grenade sailed over the compound walls. And, you know, I found myself sort of in the midst of a huge firefight for about 15 minutes. At one point I asked a sergeant, I said, well, you know, what's the mission here? And he said, well, the mission is just to hold this place. And I said, and, you know, if you guys weren't here, he said, well, the bad guys just come in and take it over again. Firefight ended in about 15 minutes. Darkness fell. We then, you know, just sort of stayed there for, you know, the next 9 hours waiting for another attack. None came. And at 3 a.m, the commanders decided, okay, we've had enough of this place. So they opened the gates, everybody loaded up onto their Humvees, and we just sort of drove back out to the 82nd base on the outskirts of town and just sort of abandoned the place. I guess having shown that, you know, they were willing to come in and back up the Iraqis if need be. So that was certainly one memorable event.
Do you know what happened there after the military left?
Shortly thereafter, the mayor fled. You know, Fallujah, I thought, was one of the few areas in Iraq that had sort of reached the tipping point where the insurgents and the population were sort of in sync to the point that U.S. troops saw the entire place as hostile and had virtually given up, you know, trying to win the hearts and minds, and were just almost engaged purely in combat operations.
What kind of protection do you have?
Well, I wore body armor and a helmet whenever I was with U.S. soldiers. And that wasn't just, you know, on patrol or anything. It was riding around on vehicles. I remember even on the 82nd base, I once walked to interview somebody like all the way across the base, which happened to be in one of, I think it was Uday Hussein's old resorts. And as I was walking through the base without my helmet, without my body armor, mortars started, you know, coming down. And, you know, they started hitting actually just as I'd gotten to the cabin of the officer I was going to interview. And, you know, I felt very vulnerable. Here I was, you know, all the way across the base, mortars are landing, I don't have my body armor, I don't have my helmet. So that sort of taught me, you know, even when you're on the U.S. bases, it's a good idea to wear your body armor and your helmet.
Is it uncomfortable?
It's actually not. You get used to it, and it's amazingly comfortable when you find yourself, you know,
under attack
in a firefight.
Yeah.
You kind of. When I was with the 82nd there in Fallujah, I felt myself, you know, trying to crawl inside my helmet. So no, it wasn't uncomfortable at all then. And it's actually not that heavy. I think the body armor that the U.S. forces wear weighs about 16 pounds, although they load it down with all sorts of, you know, grenades and magazine clips and things like that make it weigh about 40 pounds. It's a Kevlar, camouflage Kevlar vest, which itself can stop, you know, 9mm pistol shots and shrapnel. And then in the front and the back of the vests are these ceramic, very hard ceramic plates that are, you know, the product of much, you know, military research, that are both light but very strong and can stop an AK-47 round. And I interviewed soldiers over there who, you know, would pull their plates out of their vests for me and out of their vests and show me, you know, the bullet holes in their plates.
Did they not know whether they were actually hit or not? Not when they felt the impact of the bullet.
Usually they know they're hit. It's funny, a number of them told me they took a hit usually the force of the bullet knocks them right off their feet, and they start, you know, they start feeling around on their bodies for blood and wondering, you know, how badly they're wounded, you know, are they bleeding, what's really happened, and then they realize nothing has happened. You know, the bullets have hit the plates and they're okay. I wrote about one guy who was shot from about 10 yards away by an Iraqi with an AK-47. The bullet hit his front plate, ignited tracer rounds and smoke grenades hanging off his body armor, knocked him on his feet. So there he is lying on the ground. Smoke is pouring from his body. And his colleagues run up to him, and he starts asking them, am I bleeding? Am I bleeding? You know, ultimately they figured out, no, the only thing that's hit is your plate.
My guest is Vernon Loeb, defense correspondent for The Washington Post. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Vernon Loeb. He's defense correspondent for The Washington Post, and he was in Iraq most recently from mid-October through mid-November. Vernon, I'd like to ask you about a story that you covered that proved to be very controversial, and I'd love to hear your take on this. You co-wrote an article for The Washington Post about Jessica Lynch just as that story was breaking, and you reported a couple of things that turned out not to be true. Do you want to just mention what those things were that you thought were true at the time?
Yeah, we were told by some really good intelligence sources here in Washington that, you know, there were indications that she had, you know, fired back and resisted her capture and actually been shot and possibly stabbed doing so. None of this turned out to be the case, as we, you know, quickly learned. You know, we basically told our readers that day what the U.S. intelligence community was telling senior members of the U.S. government. It just kind of goes back to the old adage that, you know, initial reports from the battlefield are almost always wrong. We since went back and sort of tried to piece together what happened there. And it's kind of interesting. Apparently, part of these intelligence reports were based on, you know, signals intercepts of Iraqis talking about, you know, a blonde American firing back. And I guess those reports quickly became interpreted by some intelligence analysts to be Jessica Lynch firing back. A lot of people now think there was a blonde male sergeant or soldier firing back who might have been the blonde in these you know, signals intercepts. So, you know, the story was you know, was an accurate reflection of what the very initial sketchy intelligence was from the battlefield, which, you know, upon examination almost immediately turned out to be wrong.
So you don't think that the reports you were given were intentional attempts to mythologize or to create a hero out of Jessica Lynch so that there'd be a good positive symbol?
No, not at all. I mean, I've been asked this over and over again. Our sources for that story were not Pentagon sources. And in fact, I could never get anybody from the Pentagon to talk about those reports at all. I got indications that they had, in fact, received those intelligence reports, but the Pentagon was completely unwilling to comment on those reports at all. They wouldn't say anything about Jessica Lynch. I've never believed that, at least as far as the story we wrote goes, that it was a Pentagon attempt to create, you know, a hero there. You know, then there was her rescue, and a lot of people made the same charge there, that they had gone in with videotapes and tried to make the rescue something that it wasn't. I didn't really buy that either. I just didn't see the Pentagon trying to create a hero where there was none. I don't think they ever showed any interest in doing that to me.
What were the conversations like at the Washington Post about how to deal with it when you learned that your sources were wrong and that she it wasn't a fight to the death, she didn't resist, she didn't fire back, that she was already injured?
Well, it was kind of confusing at first because it wasn't clear what had happened initially. We got these intelligence reports right as she was being rescued. And nobody had had a chance to really examine her when these reports were coming out. The reports we received were based on, intelligence from the battlefield that had been gathered, you know, for the previous, say, week to 10 days while she was being held prisoner. So they were surfacing just as she was surfacing. And almost immediately, once she got out of Iraq, it became clear that, you know, that much of those reports were wrong because, in fact, she hadn't been shot or stabbed. But even that was confusing because she had some wounds and it wasn't really clear how she'd gotten them. I think I felt very good about the paper ultimately going back a month or two later and investigating the entire episode again and coming to, you know, a very full set of conclusions about what had happened, and finally kind of setting the record straight about, you know, what had happened to Jessica Lynch.
Do you think you've been unfairly criticized by some media watchers?
For the Jessica Lynch story?
Yeah.
I don't think so. I mean, we wrote a story that turned out to be wrong, because intelligence information we were given was wrong. I mean, that happened. It happens, you know, quite often. I mean, look at the whole war and the whole, you know, weapons of mass destruction, intelligence. It was a very sensational story. It happened at a key moment of the war. I have no problem with people saying, was the Pentagon trying to create a hero here? Were they using the Washington Post? I mean, that's fair game. I think we've done a pretty good job of explaining where we were coming from and what we did and why we did it. Again, you know, in retrospect, sure, I wouldn't have done the story, or at least I would have written it in a more, you know, or a less dramatic fashion. But, you know, at the time we wrote it, it was an absolutely legitimate story. I thought we had very good sources. As I say, the intelligence community was telling the very highest levels of the U.S. government the same thing that we reported. So at the time, we had absolutely no idea that any of this information was wrong when we reported it. And when we did find out it was wrong, we corrected it.
Vernon, one other question. We spoke just before the start of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Is there any one thing that has particularly surprised you in how the past year has unfolded?
Well, I guess I've I don't know if surprise is the right word, but just the intensity of the insurgency is something that, while a lot of people predicted it, you know, it would have been impossible to sort of completely forecast in advance. Just the difficulty of this mission we now have, I find really striking. Even with Saddam Hussein's capture, I find it hard to be too optimistic about Iraq. It's such a fragile country. It's so, you know, badly devastated by bombing, by years of sanctions. It's a fractured country with, you know, ethnic groups that mistrust each other. There are these insurgents who we can't fully identify. There are foreign terrorists coming in to some degree or another. It's an incredibly difficult mission, and I'm really struck by just how daunting the challenge is. And again, a lot of people forecast this, but it's hard to fully grasp just how difficult Iraq is going to be, probably for years to come, for this country in advance.
Well, Vernon Loeb, thank you very much for talking with us.
Sure, my pleasure.
And safe travels when you go back to Iraq.
Thanks.
Vernon Loeb is the defense correspondent for The Washington Post.